It is my privilege to introduce our speaker, Bishop Jeffrey Robinson, Auxiliary Bishop of the Archdiocese of Sydney, Australia, Emeritus. Jeffrey James Robinson was born in 1937 in Richmond. He tells me that's a town in New South Wales, Australia. There are several Richmonds, and there are about three, four, or five dozen in the United States. The schools and the towns where he received his education have wonderful names: St. Joseph's College, Hunter's Hill, St. Columba's College, Springwood, and Urbaniana University. Finally, he studied in Rome. He was ordained for the Archdiocese of Sydney in 1960. Bishop Robinson earned advanced degrees in philosophy, theology, and canon law. After a time spent in parish work, he lectured and taught canon law at the Catholic Institute of Sydney. Additionally, he served as Chief Justice of the Archdiocesan Marriage Tribunal and as Secretary, then as President, of the Canon Law Society of Australia and New Zealand. Bishop Robinson published a book on marriage, divorce, and annulment in 1984. His subsequent books explore religious experiences in our everyday lives and the Gospel of St. Mark. He is hailed for his contributions to Catholic education, raising standards for ongoing education of teachers, especially in the field of biblical studies. Bishop Robinson has gained prominence for his work in the area of ecumenism. In 1994, he was elected by the Australian bishops to the National Committee for Professional Standards. This is the committee that coordinated the Catholic Church in Australia's response to the unfolding revelation of sexual abuse by clergy. As co-chairman, Bishop Robinson became recognized for his part, a very great part, in helping and healing those who have suffered sexual abuse in his church, our church. I need to say that I see Bishop Robinson coming to us as a prophet for our times and for our church. A prophet being the one who stands in the middle of the community and calls that community to task. Bishop Robinson has written these words in his most recent book, which was already introduced to you. Listening to victims of sexual abuse is the most profound spiritual gift I have received in the last 12 years. Listening to Bishop Robinson will be a very great gift to us. Please join me in welcoming Bishop Robinson.
Gosh, after that introduction, I can't wait to hear what I have to say. I hope I can begin to live up to it. Thank you very much, one and all, for the welcome. Here it's good to have this stopover in Cleveland before continuing on tomorrow, further west. The book that I've written began its life as a response to the revelations of sexual abuse within the church. That's the raison d'etre of the book. That's what it's about. No matter how far away from the direct subject of abuse it seems to get, the whole book is about a response to those revelations. During the 9 years that I was on that committee charged with developing a national response so that we would all act together, during those 9 years I spoke with many hundreds of victims, individually and in groups. I met with offenders, I worked with bishops, and for 9 years it completely dominated my life. There were many failures, but I hope also a number of successes. It was an experience that changed me in so many ways that even if I wanted to, I couldn't go back to being the person I was before. And out of all of that came the utter conviction that if we are ever to look to the future with confidence, there must first be profound change within the church. Firstly, there must be a study of the more immediate causes of abuse. And there, I have suggested that we need to study carefully three things. Unhealthy psychology in individuals, whatever it may be. Unhealthy ideas concerning power and sex. And unhealthy living conditions. I suggest that it's when these three things come together, unhealthy psychology, unhealthy ideas, unhealthy living conditions, that we are most likely to find that murky world out of which abuse arises. And I believe that in particular, we must look at all institutional factors in the church that might contribute to any one of these three. By institutional factors, I mean factors that people are subject to simply by belonging to a particular organisation, whatever it might be. Secondly, in addition to looking at abuse, we also need to look at, with equal seriousness, at the inadequate response to abuse, because as everyone knows, that created at least as much scandal as the abuse itself. Now, I do not believe that in the ceremony of the ordination of a bishop, there is, with all that laying on of hands, a sort of microwaving of the bishop's brain. And I know that the many bishops I have worked with and known are not malicious. And so it's not enough simply to blame bishops, as though that was where all the problem lay. I believe that we must rather look at why so many decent, good, intelligent people acted in a way that, well, was simply not enough, was inadequate. Why? What again were the institutional factors that caused them to act in this way? And thirdly, it's my belief that these two areas of inquiry into the immediate causes of abuse, those three factors of unhealthy psychology, unhealthy ideas, unhealthy living conditions, and the study of the inadequate response to abuse, these two will lead to a study of all aspects of the two subjects of power and sex. After all, sexual abuse is about power and sex. Some would say it's more about power than it is about sex, but it's about both. And so, to counter abuse, we must be free to ask serious questions about both of them. Now, you're all aware that there's been criticism of my book from various places. And I believe that the fundamental difference between myself and those who are criticizing me lies precisely here. They are starting from the teachings of the church, and they're saying, these teachings have been proclaimed, you may not question them, not even in responding to abuse. I'm starting from the other end. I'm starting from the fact of abuse, and I'm saying we must investigate the causes. And in doing that, we must be free to follow the argument wherever it leads. And if it causes us to ask questions about teachings on either power or abuse or sex, then we must be free to ask those questions. If we don't, then we're attempting to respond to abuse while handcuffed and blindfolded. So I'm going to talk now briefly, I can't cover the whole of the book, I won't try to. I'm going to talk about those two subjects, power and then sex. Power. Well, the issue of power is complex, but I'll point to two factors. The first can be summed up in a misunderstanding of a sentence in the letter to the Hebrews, where it talks about priesthood and says, every high priest chosen from among human beings is put in charge of things pertaining to God on their behalf. Now, the Greek text says simply, taken. So you've got 100 people here. You take one of them and you give them this job of the things pertaining to God on behalf of other people. You might take another one and give that person the job of a doctor. You might take another and give them the job of teacher. All the Greek says is taken. But 1700 years ago, St. Jerome translated the Greek into Latin. And that word, the Greek word lambano, taken, he translated by the Latin word assumptus, which means taken up, assumed. And from that developed a whole mystique of the priesthood as in some manner taken up above other people. So you have the 100, one taken up above the others. And so the idea of the priest, and to a lesser but real extent, the religious, as somehow on a pedestal, above other people, not like them, and most insidious of all, not subject to the same rules, including even the same moral rules as the others. Now, that's an unhealthy idea. Remember, I spoke of unhealthy psychology, unhealthy ideas, unhealthy living conditions. This is an unhealthy idea. And it can lead to all kinds of abusive actions, not just sexual abuse. Indeed, one or two of you may even have met a priest who thought he was superior to you. You mean you have? It's never easy to change a mystique or an ethos, but this ethos must change. Firstly, because it denies the essential humanity of the priest and religious. And secondly, because it establishes a whole series of false relationships at the heart of the community. Priests and religious are ordinary human beings. Now, that ought to be the most obvious of statements. But I suggest both priests and religious on the one hand and Catholic people, on the other hand, have a lot of work to do here. For example, I find that wherever you have a priest doing his level best to climb down from the pedestal, you've got not just religious superiors, but Catholic people telling him to get right back up there again. When I was first ordained a bishop, I had a game of golf with this very upright Catholic gentleman. And the problem started on the very first tee. Good shot, my lord. And, you think I'm joking? No, this happened. We got up to the green. Oh, bad luck, my lord, when I missed a putt. And I said, hey, we're playing golf. My name's Jeff. Yes, my lord. You know, get back up on your pedestal. Now, there's this most dangerous insistence that priests and religious must be perfect. And no one can be, not human beings. And that if they can't be perfect, then they must at least appear to be perfect. And that's very dangerous indeed. They must be able to say, look, I messed up, I have all sorts of failings. Think about this a bit. I won't labour it too much, but how often have you criticised a priest? Don't put your hand up, just do it to yourself. How often have you criticised a priest because he's not a great preacher, or because he's not good with kids, or because he's not good at this other thing or that other thing? Who can be good at all those things? Who can? So why can't you allow someone to be, you know, Well, an awful preacher, because there's a very good priest and his sermons are actually quite excellent. But something, I don't know what it is, he gives it out in a flat monotone and he's not capable of changing that. So everybody goes to sleep. But that's who he is what I'm saying to you. Let's find other ways. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'd love to have even, you know, this is a tricky one, but even play tapes on a Sunday, sometimes at least, of a really good sermon from somewhere else. Well, you know, would that be an improvement or not? It would take away something, of course. It would take away the immediacy of a real live person. But, you know, what I'm getting at, that each one of them is a human being. He cannot be good at everything. And yet we can demand that. So I'm saying you have work to do as well as the priest. Oh, the priest has work to do too. An extraordinary number of people believe the naive idea that priests and religious are celibate, so they don't really have sexual feelings and desires the way the rest of us do. I've news for you. The second factor I want to mention under this heading of power is that of papal authority. Now, we know that the doctrine of papal infallibility states that the Pope cannot be wrong on a matter solemnly defined, the phrase is, ex cathedra. But gradually, over centuries, the protection of that ex cathedra level of papal authority has meant that other levels also had to be protected. For example, the encyclical Humanae Vitae on contraception does not use the language of infallibility. And yet, so much papal energy has been invested in that teaching on contraception that to say now that all those popes were wrong would be seen as a massive blow against all papal authority. Indeed, one may argue that the rejection of that teaching over the last 40 years has shown exactly that, as a lessening of respect for all papal authority, as more and more people have said to themselves, I'm convinced that the Pope is wrong on this issue, so how do I know he's right on other issues? And it led to a general weakening of papal authority. In the same way, most popes have rejected the very idea of women priests, and to accept it now could be seen as admitting that 2,000 years of popes have all been wrong. And so what happened, think about this, when pressure arose to discuss the matter? It was instead upgraded, and the word infallibility was introduced into the discussion so that there could be a forbidding even of discussion of the question. To take another example, is church teaching condemning homosexual acts infallible? No. But it would be defended as strongly as if it were. Why? Because once again, so much papal energy has been invested into the question. What about all church teaching on sexual morality? Well, there might be room for movement on some minor matter, but not on the core teaching, because once again, so much papal authority has been invested in that question. Well, one of the issues in my book, I talk there about did Jesus have divine knowledge? Yes, he was God, that's my profound belief. But did he have divine knowledge, or did he freely give that up? Now, I first heard this idea at least 40 years ago. It's been an open question, and Pope John Paul himself called it the frontier zone. Sorry, you call that frontier, don't you? The frontier zone of Christology, of theology about Christ today. But recently, we've had a document declaring this is, you know, yes, Jesus had divine knowledge. And the Australian bishop said that I had doubts about the identity of Jesus because I questioned that. What I'm getting at here is that phenomenon known as creeping infallibility. Yeah, but I hope you can see what I mean. there are a relatively few formally infallible statements, those given ex cathedra. But the mantle of infallibility comes down, until here we have it covering this question, which was considered open for the last 40 years. But suddenly now, it's being put under this same heading. Let's go a step lower. The law of priestly celibacy is no more than a law. It could change tomorrow. And yet to change it could imply, once again, that 1,000 years of popes have all been wrong. Once again, so much papal energy has been invested in clerical celibacy over this 1,000 years that once again to change it could imply that all those popes were wrong. Remember, the Pope lives in the Vatican. He's got all those popes around him, in his study, in his bedroom, hundreds of them. And what's he going to do? You lot were all wrong and I'm right? You know, it would take extraordinary person to do that. As a result of this, we've seen protectors of papal authority conclude that since all those popes cannot have been wrong, therefore, obligatory celibacy of priests cannot have been a significant cause of sexual abuse or even contributing cause. Therefore, they had to find another cause, and that meant another scapegoat. And you know who they found. They found priests whose sexual orientation is homosexual, and they blamed them. Now, apart from being mistaken, and that is mistaken, because a homosexual is no more likely to offend against a minor than is a heterosexual. There's no evidence of that. But apart from being mistaken, it is more importantly an avoidance of the question in order to protect papal authority. And I'll say a bit more about that in a moment. This necessity to protect not just the infallible, but all papal teaching where this creeping infallibility has come down. Firstly, though, there's another factor that must be considered, even though it's no more than a cultural factor. One does not have to be long in Italy before hearing the two phrases, bella figura and brutta figura. Now, bella figura, I can see some Italians nodding, means literally beautiful figure and ugly figure. But the real translation into English is keeping up appearances, or appearances matter. Appearances are important. The figure you present is important. Now, this idea was already powerful 2,000 years ago in the Roman Empire. So it's an idea that runs exceedingly deep in Italian culture, and Italians will freely talk about it today. There is, of course, some truth in the idea. We all present appearances. I'm doing it right now. We all do it. And yet, it's obvious that the idea is wide open to abuse, because it involves an instinctive tendency to deny and hide anything that does not create bella figura. When it is added to the need to protect all levels of papal authority, then it becomes a very dangerous idea. Before they are ordained, all bishops are required to take a special oath of loyalty to the Pope. By the way, not to God, not to the Church, to the Pope. Yeah, well, think about that. You know, why this special oath of loyalty to the Pope? I took it, but it was later, I suppose, I thought, well, just a minute, I hope I've always been loyal to God, or tried to the Church, and within that context to the Pope. Why do they need this special oath of loyalty to the Pope? Well, it's a symptom of the constant and severe pressure placed on all bishops to protect all levels of papal authority, and even the bella figura of the Pope, at all costs and in all circumstances. A very high value is put on a bishop being a Pope's man. And believe me, bishops are on an extraordinarily short leash, like 1/2 inch. And the slightest deviation is very quickly taken on. It's a pressure from above, it's a pressure from their peers. But this very high value on a bishop being a Pope's man. Well, it was this pressure that led me to a very personal conflict between my duty of loyalty to the Pope and my duty of loyalty to that portion of God's people that the Australian bishops had assigned to me, that is, victims of abuse. It was the conflict between being a Pope's man and a victim's man. And the conflict eventually became a genuine crisis for me. On the one hand, as I've said, I was constantly meeting large numbers of victims. I was trying to deal with the abuse that had happened to myself when I was young. And at the same time, there was nothing coming from the Pope. Nothing. Indeed, he failed to do anything at all with the two cases that were on his desk and couldn't go anywhere else. One concerned the then Cardinal Archbishop of Vienna, and the other concerned the founder of the Legionaries of Christ. And he did nothing. Not till the day he died did he do anything about either of those cases. Now, we are a church in which the Pope is so important. So imagine this. Imagine 20 years ago in 1988, imagine that John Paul II in St. Peter's Square one Sunday morning had said, look, I've just been informed of these terrible revelations of sexual abuse. Imagine priests sexually abusing children. It's the most horrendous thing I've ever heard. We're going to respond to this. Let's reach out to every one of these victims. Let's reach out with humility, honesty, compassion. Let's put every last one of them before the good name of the church. Let's do all we can to uncover any causes and eradicate them. How powerful that would have been. Furthermore, the very loyalty of the bishops to the Pope, had he said that, would have meant that that loyalty worked in favour of victims instead of against them. Now, I'm not going to put all the blame on one person, but that absence of leadership by the person, I mean, he has all the authority, and as everybody knows, with authority goes responsibility. So if he had that position within the church, then someone like myself trying to deal with this in a far-flung country, that's where we looked. That's where I wanted to get leadership, affirmation, support in what I was doing. And instead there was silence. And this was an extraordinarily powerful fact. Now the bishops had to be loyal, oath of loyalty, to a silent Pope. And they had to protect even his bella figura. I hope you're understanding what I'm trying to get at here, how powerful of a factor this was. There's 1,000 years of history behind the system I've described, and it constitutes a powerful and a deeply rooted culture. And to change a culture is one of the hardest tasks known to humanity. It's as hard as taking a group of Americans and trying to change them into a group of Chinese. Not just language, a whole lot of things. You're trying to change a culture, a whole way of thinking, a whole way of living. So I hope that these few thoughts give some idea of why, in responding to abuse, it is essential to go well beyond the immediate causes of abuse and to look seriously at all ways in which power is understood and exercised within the church. sex. I remember a big sign at home, big, and it had the one word on it, sex. And then underneath in tiny letters, now that we have your complete and undivided attention, would you please not throw your cigarette butts on the floor? In the First Testament, sometimes called the Old Testament, two principles had great importance in relation to sexual relationships. Now, before I get into those two, there are other statements. There are some quite beautiful statements in the First Testament about love and sexual relationships. The Song of Songs, I think, above all, because it's about love, but it's very, very explicitly about sexual love. Indeed, the couple that it talks about are clearly in a sexual relationship, but they're not married yet. So it's actually about an unmarried couple's sexual relationship. The Bible talking about this. And very, very beautiful language. Plus, there are some other extremely beautiful statements. Having said that, those quite beautiful statements are dwarfed by the vast amount you find on two other subjects, the subjects of property and purity. Now, property. In the whole of the ancient world, not just Israel, society was not based on the individual. It was based on the family. And society was a gathering of families. And each family was centered around the man as the head of the family, his wives, plural, his concubines, his children, and his slaves were all his property, literally property. And his wives and concubines were his sexual property. Now, this meant that if one of his wives had sex with another man, it was adultery, for which he could be stoned to death. But if the man had sex with an unmarried woman, it was not adultery, because he hadn't offended the rights of any man. If he had sex with another man's wife, that was adultery, because it offended the rights of another man. Right? Now, this dominated. Jesus came along and changed it, upside down, in one phrase, in the Gospel of Mark in particular, where he said that a man could commit adultery against his wife. Now, that was truly revolutionary. Not just a little change in morality, it actually upset the whole basis of society, because if he could commit adultery against her, then she was no longer simply his property. She had rights, real, you know, big rights. And so a whole new basis for the family had to be discovered, and that meant a whole new basis for society as a whole. It was a truly revolutionary statement, and many would say we're still trying to come to terms with it and implement it. The second one was the purity ethic. Now, this referred to ritual cleanness and uncleanness, such that when a person was unclean, they could not, for example, enter the temple, but had to be purified before they could. Now, the purity laws cover a wide variety of things. You'd be most familiar with all the ideas of unclean foods and the difficulty of explaining them. You know, fish were not unclean, but lobsters were. All sorts of things, quite difficult to explain. But they also touched on sexuality. So that if even a married couple had a sexual relationship, they were unclean for a period of time. A menstruating woman was unclean for the whole time of her periods. And indeed, if she sat on a chair, the chair became unclean. So that if somebody else touched the chair, they became unclean. If she childbirth, she was unclean for a number of days. You know, again, what was it? She was unclean for 7 days after giving birth to a male, but 14 days if she gave birth to a female. I'm just telling you what's in the Old Testament, okay? Now, These purity laws therefore covered quite a number of different things in relation to sexual relationships. It often used that word abomination, but don't read too much into it. Yes, it did say that homosexuality was an abomination, but so was eating lobster. So don't let's go overboard about the word abomination. Now, once again, Jesus abolished this principle when he said, nothing that enters the body from outside can make a person unclean. So there are no unclean foods, none. He said only things that come from within, from the heart and mind, you know, evil intentions, evil desires, they can make a person unclean. So Jesus abolished the two principles that had dominated in the understanding of sexuality in the First Testament. The problem for the early church was that having abolished these two principles, Jesus did not spell out any details of what he would put in their place. And this is a most important fact. Jesus did away with those two, did not spell out what he would put in their place. As a result, two things happened. Firstly, traces of those two ethics continued in Christian history. So something of the property ethic continued, and let's admit it, exists today. You know, you get a divorce, and the man will then kill the wife and children so that they will not become the property of somebody else. They're my property. And he'd kill them rather than see any. You know, it still exists. And the purity ethic still exists too in various ways. It was part of the original introduction of obligatory celibacy for priests. Things have changed and developed, but it was part of the original introduction. The idea being that there was something unclean about the idea of a priest having sex with his wife and then going straight over and celebrating Mass. That was somehow unclean. So traces have existed right up to this day. But the more important one was the church had to find a substitute. And it did find a substitute, but it did not find it in the Gospels. It found it outside. It took it, in fact, from a Jewish philosopher, Philo of Alexandria, who lived in the diaspora, that is outside Israel, surrounded by pagans, and was trying to prove the reasonableness of Jewish law. And he developed this idea in relation to sexuality of what was natural and what was unnatural. And he had his own ideas of his own time. I'll quote two of them. They're him, not me, please. He said that having sex with a menstruating woman was like sowing seed in a swamp, while having homosexual sex was like sowing seed in a desert. So he said those two are unnatural, therefore they're forbidden in the First Testament. Well, the church and Christian thinkers were influenced by Philo, and the church took it up, such that right up to our own day, you find in church teaching the idea that every natural act of intercourse must contain two elements, both the unitive element, the mutual love and support of the couple, and the procreative element, an openness to new life. So that any act of intercourse that did not contain those two was unnatural. Hence, sex strictly within marriage, and hence the condemnation of any form of artificial contraception. Now, this is not something I've dreamt up. If you don't believe me, read Humanae Vitae. That's exactly the argument that you will find there. To use the sexual faculties when either of these elements was not present was considered unnatural. And importantly, it was considered a direct sin against God, because it was going against a divine plan and indeed a divine order. And this led to unhealthy consequences. It meant that even thinking about sex was a sin. And because it was a direct sin against God, It was always a mortal sin. There were no venial sins in this field of sex. This made many people despair of avoiding mortal sin and give up on the moral life. It led to weird consequences. It led to people thinking, well, if thinking about sex is a mortal sin and doing it is a mortal sin, I might as well do it. You think I'm joking? People thought that way. Most important of all, I believe, was that it encouraged the idea of an extraordinarily angry God who would condemn a person to an eternity of punishment in hell for a single sexual thought. There are elements here so unhealthy that when put together with an unhealthy psychology and unhealthy living conditions, they can easily contribute to abuse. These are these unhealthy ideas that I mentioned at the very beginning, or some of them. Furthermore, in placing all the emphasis on the sin against God, rather than the offence against the abused minor, these ideas were a direct part of the unsatisfactory response to abuse. An offence against a minor was treated overwhelmingly and often exclusively as a sexual sin against God, and hence it was dealt with in exactly the same manner as any other sexual sin, such as thinking about sex. This meant confession, forgiveness, and restoration to the status quo, to where before. And that became a very real part of the moving of priests around. You know, the argument was, they've repented. And it was so sincere. Look, there were tears in the man's eyes. He really repented. So if I'm going to forgive him, I've got to put him back there. To do less than that would be lacking in forgiveness. I know I've been accused by a Roman cardinal of being lacking in forgiveness because I argued in these cases you couldn't put him back into the job he had. The problem is overcome only when we make a distinction between forgiving a past wrong and preventing a future evil, and not confusing the two. Yes, I believe that after pedophilia, as after any other sin, if a person truly repents, forgiveness. But that does not mean you put the person back in the job he had before because of the danger that it has caused to children. I do not believe that God gets upset by sexual desires or acts in and of themselves alone. If you're going to quote me there, quote both halves of that sentence, please. Let me repeat it. I do not believe that God gets upset by sexual desires or acts in and of themselves alone. God created sex. Why would God get upset by sex? But God gets very upset by the harm caused to an innocent child. That's where the sin is to be found. That's what gets God angry. And so in relation to sex, I believe that the first question we need to be asking is not whether it is harming some natural order determined by God, but whether it is in any way harming either another person or the community or oneself. So I'm suggesting here, So in the book I ask questions, I don't make statements. Why? Because I believe that in answering one set of absolute statements, it's not good to set up another lot of obsolete, because that merely causes argument. So I ask questions, because I hope that starts conversation. And that's what I want, conversation, not argument and confrontation. But what I'm asking about is whether we should abandon the entire sexual morality of the last 2,000 years and replace it with a morality based on persons and relationships. Now, I'm not basing it solely on not harming others, because if Jesus did not spell out the details of what he would substitute for the two ethics of property and purity, he did give the overriding principle when he said, love one another, notice, Jesus did not ever say, do not harm one another. He said, love one another. So that has to be the basis of any truly Christian ethic in this field. Not harming others, very popular today, but it has its obvious danger of brinkmanship, as though I can go up to the very brink of not harming others in satisfying my own desires. But if a whole community bases itself on that, I'm stating the obvious when I say an awful lot will go over the brink. Whereas Jesus said, love one another. So that emphatically does not mean that if you feel even a transient liking towards someone else, you can do what you like. That would not be a Christian ethic. At the very least, it means putting the other person first, as all true loving must do. Now, to take it further, I would have to recommend you to chapter 10 of the book to read all that, because there isn't a need to make careful statements in this field. And I would invite you to do that, to think about it. But I must move on. Because I have written this book, people are constantly saying to me, this is all very well, but how do we bring about the changes you speak of? Well, before I even begin to answer this part, I have no direct program to give you that will bring it about, least of all for this country, because I know my own country, I don't know yours. I do not presume to stand up and tell you this is what you must do. So all I can do is give you a few ideas. You have to take it from there. Allow me to answer it with, well, in four parts. The first is simple. Change will be most difficult. I admit that. For we're trying to change a culture, and the defences of this particular culture are 1,000 years old and exceedingly powerful. And yet, change is possible. 20 years ago, 1988, who could have foretold the fall of communism? And yet it happened the following year. Who could have foretold the fall of apartheid in South Africa? And yet it happened. Who can foretell the future? I mean, who in 1958, 50 years ago, could have predicted the church of today or the world of today? And I can't predict the world of 50 years from now. I can't predict it a few years from now. The second principle is the relationship with hierarchy in the church, with the bishops in a particular way. Now, over this issue, as everyone knows, in Boston, there was a confrontation. And I can't quarrel with that. What happened was what I think had to happen. And I think it had to happen in the way it happened. I certainly am not going to condemn